demoniac conspiracy to hide the fact of a select territory that is as important to God as Israel itself. Why? Barbarians were supposed to be there when the Romans arrived. The truth is that at the time of the Roman invasion under Julius Caesar, the city of Rome was a recent addition to the scene. The story of Brute antedates them by centuries. The story of Brute and his descendants who ruled over the Britons not only is told in that ancient narrative poem and referenced by Spenser, it's briefly told in a remarkable poem entitled The Polyolbion by Michael Drayton, a noted English poet of the days of Queen Elizabeth. We hear little of Drayton now, though critics declare he was worthy of a long remembrance. Drayton's Polyolbion, the name signifies great riches, is a collection of poems of place and combines descriptions of localities in England and Wales which, with accounts of historical or legendary characters associated with them. It is interesting to read a few verses of this composition in order to learn something. You know what's wrong with modern learners? They're too myopic. English literature people study the poems, try to get moral meanings out of them with no concept of interconnection. Art reads these pictures. They're all kinds of paintings worth millions of dollars. Art historians know the painting and know the painter, don't know the story behind it sometimes. Or if they know it, it's just a myth. Opera buffs fail to realize one of the greatest Italian operas was written about a druid priestess, a virgin, who got in trouble. We need a gestalt of history so we can see God's whole handiwork. It's interesting to read a few verses of this composition in order to learn something of the appearance and sound of a French poem. For the long lines called Alexandrines in rhymed couplet form the classic meter of the French, though they're not popular in English. In the eighth canto, or song of the Polyolbion, are the following lines, in which we note a feeling of pride in the legend that the British metropolis is some centuries older even than Rome. How mighty was that man, and mighty still to be, that gave this isle his name and to his children three, their kingdoms in the same which time doth ne'er decay, with his arrival here in primere monarchy. The ancient Britons yet a sceptered king obeyed. Interesting line. The ancient Britons yet a sceptered king obeyed 300 years before great Rome's foundations laid, and had 1,000 years in empire strongly stood, ere Caesar to her shores here stemmed the circling flood. You know, this is all in our history. The kings of Troy and Levant led tragic lives from the beginning. King Brute had 3 sons born of the beautiful Ignogi, whom we last saw fainting in the arms of her young husband as her native land receded from the ship in which he was borne away. These sons were Locrin, Albinoct, and Camber, all of whom grew to manhood in the young city of Troy Navant. Ere Brute died, after his long life of great achievements, founding of New Troy, predecessor of London, he divided his kingdom among them. To Locrin the eldest was given the sovereignty of the whole realm. Camber was made lord of the mountainous tract to the west, which we now call Wales, but which the Romans called Cambria, or Cambria, as do the Welsh, with little modification except pronunciation to this day. To Albinoct was assigned the northern country, which was named in his honor, Albania, from which Albany, New York and Kentucky, is derived. What do they teach you in school today? Locrin the ruler of the realm married Gwendolina, the daughter of Corineus, the giant killer. Now, she was a woman of great force of character, was destined eventually to act the role of a heroine. The reign of Locrin was disturbed by an invasion of barbarians from the north who poured like a flood into the land which the Trojans had cleared and made fruitful. Humber was the leader of these hordes. The two kings met for a great battle upon the banks of the river anciently known as the Abus, where after a long fight, Locrin was victorious and Humber was driven into the river and drowned. The barbarian's name was given to the stream, and also to the country to the north, which is known today as Northumberland. I mean, you know, myths or not, the history is written into modern England. Proud of his victory, the king returned to Troy and Avant, where he developed a spirit of self-indulgence. He surrounded himself with a showy court and came to regard himself as amenable to no law of justice or of right. Hey, you folks down in Albany, Kentucky, you're learning something. Maybe you already knew it. He began to neglect his queen, who had shared with him the toils of government, and he fell into temptation which so often besets a king who lives for pleasure. More than king. There are people that would pay a small fortune for a painting of Sabrina by Frost. You don't dare look at it because bare-breasted. Terrible on Sunday afternoon. Cover that up. Among his captives in the war was a maiden named Estrild, for whom he conceived a strong passion, and though polygamy was not a custom of his race, he set a bad example by claiming her as his wife. She bore him a beautiful daughter whose name was Sabrina or Sabrina. For some years, Queen Gwendolina, now she's the daughter of the giant killer. Anybody marry a daughter of a giant killer ought to keep. For some years, Queen Gwendolina suffered in silence the affront placed upon her and sought to win back her faithless spouse. It was of no avail. The king was immersed in his pleasures and thought nothing of his duty to queen and to people. Gwendolina retired to Cornwall. Why would she do that? Why would she do that? I don't understand why she would do that. Oh, Corineus was given the strip of the seashore that's now called Cornwall. Well, that makes sense. She'd go back to her daddy's land. All hangs together. Amazing. Thought I got them all caught. Gwendolina retired to Cornwall and determined upon vengeance. Am I boring you? No, many of the citizens of Troy and Avant were disaffected toward the king. They recognized in Gwendolina the strong spirit of her father, the giant killer. They enlisted under her banner, a habit, by the way, of these people. Just like they did under Deborah. They enlisted under her banner in full confidence of victory over her husband, Locrin. The king was greatly alarmed. He raised an army and marched forth to suppress the rebellion. Estrild and Sabrina, who had now become a young woman, accompanied him. It was a dreadful spectacle, the king and queen at war and their partisans engaged in destroying one another. On the banks of a large river, the battle raged. The king was taken prisoner and his followers were scattered in flight. Estrild and her daughter made frantic efforts to escape from the angry queen without success. Estrild was seized as she crossed a creek and was slain before her daughter's eyes, notwithstanding their piteous pleas for life. As for Sabrina, the daughter of Estrild, that the king took and made his wife, to the rage of the giant killer's daughter, his first wife. She was hurled into the river and rapidly bore away by the current. You art historians, do you know that you're talking about descendants of those Trojans? And you have no source for the name Sabrina, except the same stories, particularly Geoffrey of Monmouth in his History of the Kings of England. It's all been around us. Art, literature, history. What do they teach you in English history? Ever after, the river bore the name of this sad virgin, who in no wise was to blame for the misfortune of her life. The name of the river is now corrupted into the Severn. There's a notable painting by Frost entitled Sabrina, in which that unhappy maiden is depicted as a goddess of the stream, or symbol of the river itself. She is represented as being borne down the current beneath the surface, surrounded by her nymphs, who are as much at home under the water as they are in the air above. Risk one eye, folks. Gwendolina returned to Troynovant to reign alone until her son Madden, who was then a child, should reach the age of manhood. She was the first reigning queen of Britain and one of the first in all the world. Britain has never exhibited a prejudice against the sway of a queen. Always her people have had memories of the beneficent influences of women in the purple from the earliest reigns of prehistoric legend or truth. According to one version of the story, Locrin was not killed but was imprisoned to the end of his days. It is interesting to note that the tragic story of Locrin's reign once formed the subject of a spurious drama which bore the name of Shakespeare as its author. In spite of its romantic subject and its high claim to authorship, the play was poorly written and was soon dropped. But Spenser says of this forceful British queen, Gwendolina, then, as for her son, which she to Locrin bore, Madden was young, unmeet the rule to sway. In her own hand the crown she kept in store, till riper years he wrought and stronger stay. During which time her power she did display through all the realm, the glory of her sex, and first taught men a woman to obey. But when her son to man's estate did wex, she it surrendered, nay, herself would longer vex. Marries you feminists that don't know about Gwendolina. I mean, there's a slogan. And first taught men a woman to obey. Let's hear it for Gwendolina! Well, glory, at least you got the same initial. And first taught men a woman to obey. But when her son to man's estate did wex, she it surrendered, nay, herself would longer vex. I guess it was a vexatious thing. Am I boring you? When Madden reached the age of maturity, Queen Gwendolina retired to Cornwall, leaving to him the throne of Britain. For 40 years, it is said, he reigned in peace. Well, why does that bother us, 40 years? It's what the judges says. 40 years of peace ushered in. I mean, is God possibly in control of these people? Their descendants of Zara, Judah line. His sons seemed to have inherited the evil nature of their father or grandfather, Locrin. Their names were Mimpricius and Malum. It's either Mimpricius or Mimpricius. Let's just do Mimpricius. Mimpricius and Malan. Scarcely was King Madden dead when these sons began to contend with each other for the supreme power. Mimpricius treacherously induced his brother to enter into a conference with him, then murdered the prince before the eyes of the assembled ambassadors. He was a rat. He was the first British sovereign to invade the mainland of Europe. He ravaged the coast of Gaul and carried away rich treasures of gold and silver. Then, turning his attention to the improvement of his kingdom at home, after having killed his brother and ravaged Gaul, he built a new city far to the north, beyond the Humber, and named it Caer Ibraulcum. Centuries later, the Romans corrupted the latter part of the name into Iboricum. Let me see if I can do it almost like it is. Iboricum. 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 From which has come the word York. So the name of our own great metropolis, New York, like Albany, may be traced all the way back to this legendary king. Still further to the north, he built Egnid. Now, Edinburgh. The story of King Ibraicus is very strange. Now, I was skipping along. Mimpricius killed his brother. His son was Ibraicus. And it's Ibraicus that ravaged Gaul, built what is now York and Edinburgh. The story of King Ibraicus is very strange. He took to himself 20 wives, by whom he had 20 sons and 30 daughters. The boys, when they were grown, all went to the interior of northern Europe, and the girls were sent to Italy, where they eventually married. The 20 brothers created a great stir when they advanced into the northern lands. They became famous as the 20 Germans. The word meant then simply brothers or near relations, and we still use it in the latter sense when we speak of first cousins as cousins German. You either know your old English. Twenty Germans were all ready for military adventure, and they soon found it. They attracted to them the bright young men of the South, and with the assistance of these, they conquered tribe after tribe. Ibraicus himself attempted to complete the conquest of Gaul, but failed. His son, the second Brute, named after the original Brute, was more successful. He acquired the surname, which means green shield, Squeezed Green, I guess it is, from the great emerald shield which he carried very conspicuously in battle. A long period of peace followed the reigns of these warlike kings, beginning with King Leo. King Lyle, who built the city of Carlisle, now New Carlisle. After him came Hudibras, who founded Caerlim, which is Canterbury now, Caergwine, which is Winchester now, and Paladore, which was changed to Shaftesbury. The last name was built upon a mountain. While its walls were building, it is said an eagle spoke with a loud voice, and great legends surround this building. Michael Drayton speaks thus of the building of the ancient cities of Britain. Should have got this out of English literature. Nor Troy Navant alone a city long did stand, but after soon again by Ebrook's powerful hand. York lifts her towers aloft, which scarcely finished was, but as they by those kings, so by rude Hudibras, Kent's first and famous town with Winchester arose, and others built as they fit places chose. Bladud, who came next to the throne, is notable among the legendary kings. Blaudeuse.
Both as a ruler of remarkable attainments and as the father of Lear, who is famous the world over as the hero of a great tragedy by Shakespeare. Now, the history flows. Blaudeuse, it is said, was sent in his youth. Now, how about that? King Lear was a son of Judah. King Lear was a son of Judah. Let me drop a little bomb right now. Where are the 10 tribes going to end up? These same British Isles. You ever noticed in that second chapter of Micah in the Old Testament, 12th verse, prophecy, Micah is prophesying concerning Samaria and Jerusalem, the ancient names, Samaria being the northern kingdom, Jerusalem the southern kingdom. What is the transgression of Jacob? Is it not Samaria, he says, in the fifth verse, first chapter? And what are the high places of Judah? Are they not Jerusalem? He's going to prophesy against them. I will surely assemble, he says in the 12th chapter, the 12th verse, chapter 2, I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of thee. Now we're back to the father of both of them. Samaria, Ephraim, sons of Joseph that received the birthright except for what was given to Judah, which was the scepter and lawmaking. I will surely assemble, O Jacob, all of thee. I will surely gather the remnant of Israel. I will put them together as the sheep of Bozrah, as the flock in the midst of their fold. They shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. The breaker has come up before them. They have broken up and have passed through the gate and have gone out by it. There's Micah's record of what Ezra records, that after the Judah kingdom returned from Babylon, the invitation went out for the 10 tribes in Assyria to come back. They took counsel and instead for a year and a half, with great noise and tumult, passed through the headwaters of the Euphrates. Here is the King James reference of that. The breaker has come up before them. They shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. The breaker has come up before them. They've broken up. They've passed through the gate. They're gone out by it. Let me just put a parenthesis right there and stop for a minute. Hosea. Those that are going to be scattered, the first chapter, become known as not my people, page 977, Hosea chapter 1. 977, you've got a Bible like mine. Scattered, Jezreel, not having mercy, Lo Rahama, not my people, Lo Ami. Yet they'll go to a place where they'll become as abundant as sand and stars and become sons of God in that place. Hosea in the second chapter says in the prophecy, I will sow her unto me in the earth. Then the fourth verse of the third chapter, for the children of Israel shall abide many days without a king and without a prince, without a sacrifice, without an image, without an ephod, without a teraphim. Afterward shall the children of Israel return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. Now put that in the parenthesis. They shall make, go back now to Micah. See, these prophets had their own little glimpses. You've got to put the mosaic together. I will assemble all of thee, gather the remnant, put them together. They shall make great noise by reason of the multitude of men. Esdras takes them through the Caucasus, looking for Arsareth. Haggai says, or rather Hosea says, they'll be scattered, not my people, not having mercy. They'll be without
a king, without a priest, without a prince, without an ephod. Another passage, you'll even forget the Ark of the Covenant.
The breakers come up before them. They've broken up, have passed through the gate, and are gone out by it. Ezra says the river Euphrates, God dried it up and let them go over it. Not the Revelation passage, but Esdras. No different than when he took them out of Egypt. Now in the parenthesis, many days without a king. Why are they without a king? Their king shall pass before them. Doesn't mean in front of. The original is in a time span ahead of them. God would send their king. They only had one king under God. Descendants of Judah, they had the scepter, who ultimately must be joined with the line of David. Now, how did God send a king ahead of them? Descendants of Judah through Zarah were already ruling. We haven't gone to Ireland yet, the high kings of Ireland, the Milesian kings, also from Zarah. But in England, the descendants of Brute are already ruling. God, in his master plan, centuries even before Rome, sending his king ahead of them so that the prophecies might be fulfilled. The Lord led them. A breaker opened the way. They go through the Caucasus Mountains, as Ezra says, as Micah hints. They settle north of the Black Sea, north of the Caucasus. As Celts, they'll cover northwestern Europe ultimately to descend in this territory in the bringing of the tribes into the place promised by God when he told David that he would create a dynasty when Nathan the prophet came and would put his people Israel in a place where they wouldn't have to move. Obviously not Israel, they were already there. King came ahead of. How many times? I doubt seriously some of these Hollywood actors and Shakespearean actors even know the story of Brute when they play King Lear. Ladu came next to the throne, father of King Lear. Bladud, it is said, was sent in his youth to Greece to improve his education. The Greeks, even in that day, had attained a marvelous civilization again. Many centuries later, it became the custom of the Roman nobles to send their sons to Greece. Bladud had a bright and inquiring mind. He eagerly studied the civilization of the Greeks. Said that at Athens, he even excelled the priests who instructed him. Returning to Britain, he at once sought to interest his court in many lines of improvement. His attention was attracted to the springs discovered at a place which he afterward named Carabaden. The waters were found to possess medicinal virtues of a high order. He conceived the idea of building here a resort for health seekers. His enterprise was highly successful. The place is now the city of Bath, world famous for its healthful waters. King Bladud lost his life in an attempt to fly. The wings he formed failed to support the adventurous king. He fell heavily upon the roof of the temple of Apollo, and Troy Navant was instantly killed. The long reign of Bladud's son, King Lear, was a period of peace and prosperity. Only in his old age did misfortunes come upon him. And then they were of so cruel a nature that the readers of Shakespeare are inexpressibly saddened by their portrayal. Indeed, so many a feeling of some that Shakespeare's drama of King Lear should never be put on stage because you walk out so sad. Lear had no son to succeed him. He had three daughters, Goneril, Regan, and Cordelia, all of whom treated him with great respect, though the two eldest were wicked at heart and feigned for him a love they didn't feel. Goneril was married to the Duke of Albany and Regan to the Duke of Cornwall. Cordelia, the youngest, you know, you got problems. Cordelia the youngest was not married, but her hand was sought at the same time to the King of Gaul and the Duke of Burgundy, both of whom a representative being those Frenchmen, both of whom are representatives being present at the court at the time when the drama opens. The old king, feeling that his death could not be far off, rashly determined to abdicate, leaving the government to younger strengths for the remainder of his life, maintaining for his dignity only a royal guard of chosen knights. Before making a division of his kingdom, he asked his daughters separately how much they loved him. Goneril fairly outdid herself in extravagant professions of love and loyalty. So fulsome was her flattery, the eldest daughter, that the king had he not been old and childish, might have detected the absurdity and insincerity of it, but he didn't. Now Reagan, the second daughter, sought to go further, if possible, than her sister. She had no words, she said, to express her love for him. The true-hearted and sensible, you've all seen this in Shakespeare's drama. The true-hearted and sensible Cordelia knew not what to say in competition with her sisters and resolved to make no such attempt. She replied simply and sensibly that her love was what her duty bade, nothing more nor less. The foolish king, instead of commending her sensible course, considered her wanting in affection and obstinate, and he warned her of his extreme displeasure. The honest girl repeated her statement. She insisted that a wife's love and duty were due in part to her husband, and that hers would be when she should marry. The old boy would have to share some of it with her husband to come. She showed her disapproval of the insincere and excessive praise and laudations of her sisters. The old king, becoming enraged, excluded her from any share in his kingdom. I know we're about to leave Kentucky. I'm racing. The old king, so enraged, he left Cordelia out, and he divided everything between Goneril and Reagan. Cordelia, though she had been his favorite child, was given to the king of Gaul as a dowerless bride. Well, Cordelia was given to the king of Gaul as a dowerless bride and left the home of her childhood under the cloud of her father's wrath and her sister's scorn. The Earl of Kent endeavored in vain to change the determination of the old king. And though he'd been a faithful friend and servitor of the king, he so aroused the royal fury that he too was commanded to leave the kingdom within 5 days on pain of death. It was arranged that the king, after his abdication, should retain his title while he should live, and that with his retinue of 100 knights, he should live alternately with the 2 daughters that he had divided his kingdom among. The 2 elder daughters, when they had secured from their aged father his power and wealth, ignored their former protestations of affection, broke their promises, treated him with heartless meanness, compelling him to discharge his bodyguard, which was all he had left to remind him of his days of kingship. Finding life unendurable with them, he turned to Cordelia, whom he himself had treated with such injustice. Cordelia, sent dowerlessly to Gaul, when she learned that her father had arrived in Gaul, did what? You all have seen Shakespeare. You all know how this story ends. You know where I'm going? To King Arthur. I'm heading right on down the trail. But en route to King Arthur, I'm going to encounter Joseph of Arimathea, who brings Judah's line via Pharaoh's into the line of the kings. And then I'm going to come to Constantius. You know the old song? Didn't you remember it as a kid? Old King Cole was merry old soul was he. He called for his pipe, he called for his bowl, one or the other, and for his fiddlers, 3. You know that? You just don't know where it comes from, do you? You don't. Well, he had a daughter named Helena. And Helena married Constantius, the Roman emperor. And they had a son, Constantine. And Constantine became the Roman emperor. And in his veins were flowing the blood of these British kings that contain both the line of Pharaohs and Zara. And Constantine conquers all the Roman Empire, being emperor after Constantius, with the blood of Helena in his veins, and Christianizes the entire Roman Empire, founds Constantinople, and it is his mother Helena of old King Cole who opens the Holy Land to the Christians again for the first time. And you think God doesn't have control on history? Wouldn't it be awful to be a dumb Christian and only learn two verses of Scripture and die? I mean, you wouldn't even know who you were meeting when you got up there and you saw God. You know, it's okay to be a newborn babe in Christ, but you need to grow up a little and learn how smart your daddy is. Our Heavenly Father has really got it all together. You know, I'd be scared to death if I was an evil Russian today, knowing I was fighting against him. I mean, God really runs the show. You know, if I could just teach all the time, I wouldn't talk back to God half as much as I do. I mean, you know, when I get into it and see how smart he is, I mean, yes, sir. What is it? What is it you want, God? You know, not anything you say, Lord. We have to do these other things. I forget all this. When I read all this, I know victory's coming.